Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. We're reading this week from the December 25th, 2020 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows three of our founding fathers in front of the American flag. George Washington has a kind of a sad look. He looks like he's got a tear rolling down his cheek. Thomas Jefferson is holding his face in his hands just in disbelief. And Alexander in the middle between the two, Alexander Hamilton, has his hand on his forehead with an "oh my gosh" sort of look. The title is "Defiling Democracy: Will Trump's False Claims of Fraud Leave Lasting Damage?" And that is our first main story. We'll start right there. Biden's win official, but Trump's still in denial. What happened? Joe Biden was officially declared winner of the presidential election this week, capping 6 weeks of fruitless efforts by President Trump to overturn his loss with baseless claims of voter fraud, an unprecedented challenge to democracy backed by many Republican lawmakers. After electors in all 50 states and the District of Columbia cast ballots Monday, Biden's win of 306 electoral votes to Trump's 232 was certified, effectively ending Trump's campaign to reverse the outcome of an election he lost by 7 million votes, 51.4% to 46.9%. Last week, 126 House Republicans signed on to a Texas lawsuit asking the Supreme Court to throw out millions of votes in other states and install Trump as president. But after the Electoral College vote, many Republicans surrendered. "At some point, you have to face the music," said Senator John Thune of South Dakota. And Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell broke weeks of silence on the matter to congratulate President-elect Joe Biden and urge Republicans to accept the result. Biden denounced the attacks on the election and praised election officials for not buckling to pressure and threats. "In this battle for the soul of America, democracy prevailed," he said. The Electoral College vote followed the Supreme Court's summary dismissal of the Texas lawsuit, which sought to nullify the results in four battleground states. The rejection of the unusual suit, which was backed by 18 state attorneys general, marked the end of the road for a campaign of legal challenges to the election that faced withering rejections by dozens of judges, leaving Trump's legal team with a win-loss record of 1-59. Still, Trump refused to concede, with his campaign announcing he would hold an alternative inauguration on January 20th at the winter White House, Mar-a-Lago. "We won every one of them," Trump said, of the contested states. What the editorial said: "It is now time for Republicans to move on," said WashingtonExaminer.com. "Now that the Supreme Court has dismissed the ludicrous Texas suit and the electors have delivered the coup de grace, there is no longer any acceptable excuse to deny Biden's victory. Even if Trump refuses to face reality, Republicans must not follow him off the cliff." "This week will be remembered as a low point in American politics," said the San Diego Union-Tribune, "that nearly two-thirds of House Republicans and 18 GOP state attorneys lined up behind a specious effort to overturn legal ballots just because they didn't like the results shows how deeply Trumpism has infected and warped the party. It points towards a new normal in which facts, logic, and reality don't matter if they don't cohere with ideology." what the columnist said. The Texas lawsuit was the first shot in a new civil war, said Lucian Truscott IV in Salon.com. It amounted to nothing less than an act of sedition by the entire Republican Party. Having given up on democracy this country was founded on, the GOP is now standing by silently as election officials and legislators face death threats, mobs gather outside their homes, and Proud Boys rampage through the streets of Washington, attacking black churches. These people have seceded from sanity and reason. Trump's farcical coup didn't succeed, said Jonathan Last in TheBulwark.com. But the goal wasn't really to win in court. It was to win the battle for the soul of the Republican Party. Far too many have signed their souls over, said Timothy Carney in WashingtonExaminer.com. They went along even as Trumpism demanded defending immoral behavior and harmful slanders and conspiracy theories. Forced to choose between Trump and the rule of law, many failed the test. This farce isn't funny anymore, said Jamel Bowie in the New York Times. We have to face an unsettling truth. The Republican Party, or much of it, has abandoned whatever commitment to electoral democracy it had to begin with. It is now officially the party of minority rule, one that views the votes of people unlike themselves as inherently illegitimate, and defeat as unacceptable. Not since the 1850s has such a view captured an entire political party. What happens next time, asked Zeynep Tufekci in TheAtlantic.com. Yes, Trump's attempted coup was buffoonish, but he's writing a playbook for stealing elections that's drawn wide support in a party desperate to maintain power in the face of demographic change. It's not enough to count on our institutions to resist such onslaughts. They rely on adherence to norms, and once people decide that the rules are different, the rules are different. We escape disaster this time, but if there's a smarter authoritarian and a closer election next time, our luck may run out. And we'll also take in our second main story. COVID vaccinations begin as pandemic intensifies. What happened? The U.S. administered the first shots of Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine to frontline healthcare workers and nursing home residents this week, offering hope that the disease could be contained even as the pandemic entered its deadliest stretch. With the nation's coronavirus death toll topping 300,000 after 17,000 fatalities were registered in 7 days. Sandra Lindsay, a 52-year-old intensive care nurse in New York City, was the first American to get the vaccine outside of a clinical trial. I hope this marks the beginning of the end of a very painful time in our history, Lindsay said. About 2.9 million shots of Pfizer's vaccine are being delivered across the country. The firm hopes to deliver 25 million doses by December 31st, enough to inoculate 12.5 million people. Moderna could soon start shipping 20 million shots of its experimental two-dose vaccine, which the FDA said this week is 94% effective in preventing the illness. But with more than 200,000 new COVID cases being registered daily in the U.S. and a record 112,000 people hospitalized with the disease, epidemiologists project that vaccines will prevent only 25,000 deaths by April 1st. At that point, the death toll could be at 500,000. The Trump administration has ordered enough doses of the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines to immunize 150 million Americans by July 1st, less than half the U.S. population. Dr. Anthony Fauci, the nation's top infectious disease expert, says the general population could start being vaccinated in late March if other shots now being trialed, such as Johnson & Johnson's and AstraZeneca's, prove effective. What the editorial said. Developing these vaccines in record time was an extraordinary achievement, said the New York Times. But we risk messing up the next big challenge, actually getting people vaccinated. Most states lack plans to distribute the vaccine, and nearly half don't have databases to track who gets inoculated. Crucial information when a vaccine requires two shots, several weeks apart. Hospitals, state health departments, and other institutions that will help administer vaccines are running on fumes, and the federal government has so far funded less than $400 million of the estimated $8.4 billion needed to execute this epic operation. The arrival of effective vaccines is a victory for the Trump administration amid its otherwise disastrous handling of the contagion, said the San Francisco Chronicle. Yet even this success has been marred by missteps, such as the administration's decision in November to not lock in an extra 100 million doses of Pfizer's vaccine for delivery by June 2021. That mistake will prolong an unprecedented mass inoculation that is already expected to take months. What the columnist said. States will select their own priority for vaccination, said Dr. Lena Nguyen in WashingtonPost.com. And whatever they decide, many people will be angry. Ethical questions are piling up. Should people with higher risk for severe disease, such as the elderly, be prioritized over those living in condition rife for infection, such as inmates? Is a meatpacker more of an essential worker than a teacher? These hard choices must be made quickly. With bodies piling up, it would be tragic for vaccines to sit unused while policymakers argue. Businesses are already lobbying to jump the vaccination line, said Walter Shapiro in NewRepublic.com. The American Bankers Association wants the Centers for Disease Control to define bank employees as essential workers. The NHL is reportedly seeking a private supply of the vaccine for its players. Uber is pressuring California to give its underpaid drivers priority. Joe Biden must use his presidency to call out anyone who elbows his or her way into line and remind people that we're all in this together as Americans. This should be the season of hope, said Nicholas Kristof in the New York Times. We now have two highly effective vaccines, and by next summer we should be able to meet and hug each other again. Except by then, hundreds of thousands of us will no longer be around. More Americans have died from COVID in 9 months than in combat during 4 years of World War II. We're losing more Americans to the virus daily than perished on 9/11. The death toll in the coming months could be massively reduced if only more of us would wear masks and avoid crowded indoor spaces where the virus lingers in the air. This is the test of our lifetimes. Let's stop failing it. Our controversy of the week is titled Hunter Biden, How to Investigate the President-Elect's Son. So Hunter Biden's business is news after all, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. Who knew? Back in October, the New York Post published damning emails retrieved from the laptop of Hunter Biden, 50, son of the now President-Elect. But the mainstream media dismissed the story as Russian disinformation, funneled through President Trump's personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani. Now, with the election over, the truth is coming out. This week, Hunter Biden confirmed that federal prosecutors in Delaware are investigating my tax affairs while denying any wrongdoing. Credit should go to outgoing Attorney General William Barr for keeping the investigation secret during the campaign. Meanwhile, the Justice Department's investigations into his son, including a second one by the U.S. attorney in Pittsburgh into information from Ukraine provided by Giuliani, certainly complicate life for whomever Mr. Biden nominates to be his attorney general. These investigations should shame news outlets and so-called intelligence experts who dismiss the Hunter Biden story as a smear, said Rich Lowry in NationalReview.com. They deliberately misled the public. Nice try, said Jonathan Chait in nymag.com. The unsurprising news that the president-elect's hot mess of a son may have tax problems is completely unrelated to the New York Post fizzled bombshell. The allegation then was that Joe Biden was corrupt and that he'd improperly used his clout as vice president to shield Hunter's Ukrainian employer, Burisma, from investigation. That claim has repeatedly been proven false. In addition, the FBI has reportedly examined the laptop Giuliani provided and found no crimes or anything related to the tax investigation. Try telling that to Fox News, said Alex Shepard in NewRepublic.com. Fox and other right-wing media are giving nonstop sensationalized coverage of Hunter's tax woes as a kind of Benghazi scandal they will flog night and day to damage Joe Biden. This case demands a special prosecutor, said Andrew McCarthy in NationalReview.com. Federal investigators have reportedly found that Hunter received highly lucrative, highly suspicious streams of income from China, Ukraine, and Russia, some of it while Biden Sr. was involved with foreign policy in those countries. The case needs to be walled off from Joe Biden's Justice Department appointees. That's neither necessary nor advisable, said William McGurn in the Wall Street Journal. If Biden simply lets the Republican-appointed U.S. attorney overseeing Hunter's case finish his work, it will show Biden is serious about his pledge to run a nonpartisan Justice Department. Investigate away, said Molly Jong Fast in Vogue.com. But if presidential offspring are fair game, shouldn't we also find out what Ivanka Trump and her husband, Jared Kushner, have been up to since 2017? They continue to make more than $35 million a year while serving as senior advisors to the president, with the power to influence policies affecting their own businesses. Indeed, Ivanka's self-dealing during the 2017 inauguration is already facing legal scrutiny by the Washington, D.C. Attorney General. Time will tell whether Hunter committed any crime, said Ed McCaffrey in CNN.com. But after the past 4 years, it's highly encouraging that Biden Sr. reacted to the bad news about his son, not by tweeting witch hunt and hoax, but by assuring Americans he would not interfere. It's not my Justice Department, it's the people's Justice Department, the president-elect said. That alone is a cause for celebration. And we'll roll right into our Good Week, Bad Week segment. It was a good week for thinking positively after SpaceX CEO Elon Musk tweeted, "Hell yeah," when a test flight crashed while landing in Texas. "The flight yielded all the data we needed," Musk said, "despite excessive touchdown velocity and rapid, unscheduled disassembly." It was a good week for enforcement after actor Tom Cruise reportedly flew into a rage when he saw crew members breaking social distancing rules on the set of the already delayed Mission Impossible 7. "If I see you doing it again, you're blanking gone," Cruise yelled. And it was a good week for PPE, with the recommendation by China's Civil Aviation Administration that its flight attendants wear disposable diapers and avoid using the lavatories to minimize their risk of coronavirus exposure. But it was a bad week for soaring oratory after former vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin asked a crowd in Georgia to pray for God to heal our land, not just geographically and geology-wise, but people-wise. It was a bad week for precocity after a 12-year-old New York City boy stole his parents' Range Rover and took his 7-year-old cousin on a 5-hour, 100-mile, multi-state joyride. "Yeah, it was good," the little girl told police when they were caught, adding, "I wish I was driving." Finally, it was a bad week for retiring to Florida after neighbors of President Trump's Mar-a-Lago estate in Palm Beach petitioned the town to bar Trump from moving there, citing a 1993 legal agreement in which Trump promised not to spend more than 21 days a year at the estate. "Palm Beach should notify Trump now," the petition says, "to avoid an embarrassing situation later." We're on the briefing page, titled this week, The Arab World's Most Important Man. Who is Mohammed bin Zayed? As Crown Prince of the Emirate of Abu Dhabi and de facto ruler of the United Arab Emirates, Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan, known as MBZ, is one of the most powerful leaders in the Middle East. Jutting out from the southeastern edge of Saudi Arabia, the UAE is a tiny federation of city-states, home to 1 million citizens and 8 million foreign workers. But it sits in a strategically crucial spot opposite Iran on the Strait of Hormuz, a narrow waterway in the Persian Gulf through which much of the world's oil is exported. The UAE was founded 49 years ago by MBZ's father, Zayed bin Sultan Al Nahyan, and in that time the Sunni Muslim nation has transformed from the desert home of squabbling Bedouin tribes into an oil and natural gas powerhouse and global business hub. MBZ 59 controls a sovereign wealth fund of $1.3 trillion and has made it his mission to contain Shiite Iran and to crush any form of populist Islamism, particularly the Sunni Muslim Brotherhood, that might endanger the rule of Arab monarchies. How is MBZ taking on those threats? MBZ has spent hundreds of billions of dollars building the most advanced military in the Arab world, leading U.S. officials to nickname the UAE Little Sparta. The UAE has an arsenal of American weaponry, an army led by former U.S. officers, and bulked up with Colombian, South African, and other mercenaries, and a high-tech intelligence service shaped by ex-U.S. spies. MBZ has used the military freely, most prominently to wage war alongside the Saudis against Iran-backed Houthi rebels in Yemen. In Libya, MBZ has violated a United Nations embargo by sending arms, air support, and Sudanese fighters to warlord Khalifa Haftar, who is battling the Turkish-backed Islamist-dominated central government. In Syria, he has sought to help Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad in his war on Turkish supported Islamist rebels. We have created a little Frankenstein, said Tamara Kaufman-Witz, a fellow at the Washington-based Brookings Institution. Is he close with the Saudis? MBZ is considered the true force behind the rise of Saudi Arabian Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, the kingdom's 35-year-old de facto ruler. When bin Salman ousted and succeeded his cousin Mohammed bin Nayef as Crown Prince in 2017, and then purged all those loyal to the previous leadership, detaining hundreds of officials and members of the royal family, it was MBZ who was whispering in his ear. MBZ then convinced Washington that bin Salman was a man they could deal with. The relationship, says William Law, editor of Arab Digest, is one where MBZ exploits the immaturity, the arrogance, and the ambition of MBS to achieve his ends. Bin Zayed helped push Saudi to invade Yemen in 2015, for example, and 2 years later to blockade Qatar, which has cooperated with Iran and funded Islamist movements. What does the U.S. think of him? Trained at a British military academy, MBZ impressed American officials early on by persuading his father to pay $4 billion to the U.S. in 1991 to help fund the Gulf War. Former President Barack Obama spoke often with MBZ while in office until the two fell out over the Arab Spring. Obama supported the rise of Arab pro-democracy movements, but MBZ argued that elections would produce only Islamist leaders. The Middle East, he once wrote, is not California. His prediction proved true in Egypt, and the UAE bankrolled the 2013 military coup that replaced President Muammar Morsi, a member of the Muslim Brotherhood, with General Abdel Fattah el-Sisi. Ties with the U.S. have strengthened under President Trump, whose son-in-law and advisor Jared Kushner held a secret meeting with MBZ, a month before Trump took office. More recently, the White House agreed to sell the UAE 50 advanced F-35 fighter jets as part of a $23 billion arms deal. That sale is seen by many analysts as a reward for the UAE normalizing diplomatic relations with Israel this summer. What's MBZ's human rights record? The UAE is more tolerant than many Arab nations. Unlike Saudi Arabia, it allows foreign workers to worship in Christian churches and Hindu temples. Women have more rights than in neighboring countries. A third of the UAE cabinet members are women. But the UAE has no press freedom and a hideous record of abusing the low-wage Asian migrants who have built and worked in cities such as Abu Dhabi and Dubai. NBC has viciously suppressed domestic dissent. Voicing support for Qatar on social media can result in prison time, and closely surveils activists, journalists, and politicians. The war in Yemen has caused massive suffering, with more than 20,000 civilians dead and 10 million at risk of famine. How will he deal with Biden? NBC knows Joe Biden well from the Obama administration, and he was quick to congratulate the president-elect on his victory in November. But he realizes that a Biden administration will be less accommodating toward Emirati military adventurism and more critical of its human rights records. Biden did support Trump's Abraham Accords deal between Israel and the UAE, but Biden's nominee for Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, has expressed concerns about the F-35 sale. A bipartisan group of senators failed to block that deal last week, but because delivery of the planes will take years, the Biden administration could still undo the transfer. Preventing that will be a top goal for MBZ over the next 4 years. We'll read a few of the best columns of the week, starting with Why Biden Won't Have a Honeymoon. Like George W. Bush and Barack Obama before him, Joe Biden has called for unity and bipartisan cooperation, said Matthew Continetti. He will run into the same harsh reality that has dominated politics for more than two decades, a stalemate between two parties that are closely divided electorally but deeply divided ideologically. After a relatively narrow victory in several swing states, Biden takes office without strong congressional majorities to push his agenda through. The resistance he will face in Congress and the country is the result of a profound disagreement over values, over how best to improve America. In an era of intense polarization, there is little political incentive for cooperation. The party's hold on power is so tenuous that every concession disheartens supporters and energizes opponents. Once Biden begins making choices, his political capital as a new president will quickly be used up. Half the country will angrily reject more coronavirus restrictions and easing of restrictions on immigration, green energy policies that halt oil and gas development, new limits on gun rights, and an expansion of abortion and LGBTQ rights. Bush and Obama tried to unify the nation around them, but failed. Now, it's Biden's turn. A terrible economic record. Contrary to the myth he's promoted, President Trump will leave office in January with a historically bad record on the economy, said John Harwood. Chief Economist Mark Zandi of Moody's Nonpartisan Credit Service recently studied the record of the 13 presidents since World War II and found that Trump will be the only one to exit the White House with fewer Americans employed than when he started and with smaller growth in economic output than any of those predecessors. Trump's America First policies did not bring back factories from China, and his trade war failed to coerce Beijing into making the policy reforms he demanded. Yes, the $1.5 trillion tax cut he signed, mostly for corporations and the rich, provided a short-lived sugar high to an economy already near full employment, but the boost faded even before the pandemic hit. The pandemic's impact on the economy was devastating, but responding to unexpected catastrophe is a big part of a president's job. Trump botched that test horribly. His lies about the seriousness of the viral threat led to far more deaths, illnesses, and economic damage. Trump is leaving his successor with a massive economic mess. This is from Europe, from Spain. Keeping the migrants offshore. The Canary Islands are fast becoming the new frontier of Europe's migration crisis, said Augusto del Carrer Palacios. So far this year, some 20,000 migrants have made the 60-mile voyage from northwestern Africa to the Spanish archipelago, 10 times more than arrived in 2019. In November alone, a record 8,000 landed on the islands. Some of these desperate souls were fleeing Islamist militias in Mali or election-related violence in Guinea or the Ivory Coast. Others were simply convinced a better life awaited on European soil. But the risks are extreme. About 1 in 24 drown while attempting the crossing. The rest are crowding the islands, which don't have the infrastructure to house or support so many people in need. The local government in the Canaries is demanding that the burden be shared by the rest of Spain. And indeed, one would think that a country of more than 47 million people would have the means and capacity to host a few thousand refugees. But even though almost half of the reception places on the mainland are empty, Madrid won't lift a finger. With Spain unable or unwilling to deal with the issue, and many African countries denying repatriation, the Canaries risk becoming prison islands for migrants stranded on Europe's doorstep. Time for our in-depth article, The Last Word. This week, titled Freedom, Masks, and Death. As the COVID body count piled up in the town of Mitchell, South Dakota, longtime neighbors struggled to agree on mandating even the most basic precautions, said Annie Gowan in the Washington Post. A cold wind whipped through the prairie as they laid Buck Timmons to rest. Timmons, a longtime coach and referee, was not the first person in Mitchell, South Dakota, population 15,600, to die of the coronavirus. He was not even the first that week. As the funeral director tucked blankets over the knees of Timmons' wife, Nancy, Pastor Rhonda Wellstadt-Zell told a small group of masked mourners that just as there had been seasons in the coach's life, basketball season, football season, volleyball season, Mitchell was now enduring a phase of its own, pandemic season. In a state where Republican Governor Kristi Noem has defied calls for a statewide mask mandate, even as cases hit record levels, many in this rural community an hour west of Sioux Falls ignored the virus for months, not bothering with masks or social distancing. Restaurants were packed, big weddings and funerals went on as planned. Then people started dying. The wife of the former bank president, a state legislator, the guy whose family has owned the bike shop since 1959, then Timmons, a mild-spoken 72-year-old who had worked with hundreds of local kids during six decades as a little league and high school coach and referee. His death shook Mitchell just as its leaders were contemplating something previously denounced and dismissed, a requirement that its staunchly conservative residents wear masks. As Wellstant Zell led those morning Timmins in the hymn, Jesus Loves Me, the rumble of an approaching helicopter cut through the sound of the singing and the mourners' soft tears. In Mitchell, the medical emergency helicopter, once a rare occurrence, now comes nearly every day, ferrying the growing number of people desperately ill with COVID to a hospital that might be able to save them. Sirens echoing through the empty streets of New York marked the pandemic's first phase, swirling blades of helicopters on the American plains as the soundtrack of a deadly fall. Oh, my God, here we go again, Wellstat Zell thought. Another one. News of Buck Timmons' death spread quickly through the town just hours before the first vote. Kevin McArdle, the city council president, heard the news in a text from a fellow referee and was shocked. He had not even known Timmons was sick. How could he be dead when McArdle had seen him filling up his tank at the gas station just a few days ago? Timmons fell ill with the virus on October 24th. Nancy was pretty sure he'd picked it up at one of the many games he went to where people were casual about wearing masks. She had stitched Buck a mask out of quilt scraps in the most manly pattern she could find, brown with little yellow flowers, but she wasn't sure if he always wore it when he was out of her sight. They both became ill at the same time, but Nancy had a mild case. Buck seemed okay, too, until about a week in, when he became weaker and weaker and didn't want to eat or drink, or leave his old brown leather recliner. She plied him with all the flavors of Gatorade, Smart Water, and Ensure she could find, but he drank very little. Because Buck was not having trouble breathing and the hospital had patients who were far sicker, he stayed at home. Nancy, a retired X-ray technologist, administered his oxygen and insulin treatments. That morning, November 16th, Buck woke after a restless night and called out for his wife. He mumbled something. She thought he said, "I love you," so she wrapped her arms around his head and said, "I love you too." Just after noon, he was gone. They had planned on taking an Alaskan cruise together next year, but now she was alone, 10 days before Thanksgiving with a stack of bills on the table she wasn't sure how to pay. "It's just not there," she said. "So much life left, and then it's just not there." 3 hours later, McArdle walked into the Corn Palace, the city's civic center and auditorium, with Buck Timmons' death heavy on his mind. Timmons had coached in his little league. They had refereed high school sports together. Now his eyes rested briefly on the spot in the bleachers behind the visitors' bench where Timmons, in his role as state coordinator for high school refs, always sat during games. McArdle had a yellow legal pad under his arm with his daily tally of coronavirus cases in Davison County since March. He had been so carefully recording had exploded in the recent weeks, from 359 cases on October 1st to 1,912 that morning, a 433% increase. Locally, 10 people had died in less than 7 weeks. McArdle said he found the numbers as alarming as the public health officials did. He is a 57-year-old camper salesman whose biggest worry as council president before the coronavirus was cleaning up algae in the town lake. But when Susan Tarks, the lone woman on the council, had raised the idea of a mask mandate a month earlier, he had ridiculed her for wearing one and grumbled, "You don't see the grocery stores putting mandatory masks in. Nobody would go to them. They'd lose business." Now McArdle and others on the council, rattled by Timmons' death, listened attentively to Tarks' proposal, sitting at socially spaced tables on the auditorium basketball court in front of murals depicting their hardy pioneer ancestors. The draft ordinance would require masks in buildings and public spaces, with a fine of up to $500 and 30 days in jail. During the public comment section, a handful of anti-maskers spoke, alleging that masks don't work and that the measure was an overreach that would violate their civil rights. Local doctors and nurses, overrun by COVID-19 patients, pleaded for help. "Every single day I come to work and have more and more positive COVIDs," said Diane Kinkle, a nurse practitioner who runs a small independent health clinic in town. The stress on the hospitals is very real. It's really scary as a provider to come to work and have very ill people and know there might not be a hospital bed for you. The Mitchell County Council passed the draft measure unanimously, November 16th. But Mayor Bob Everson, one of the mass doubters, still had to issue an executive order to put it in place. And the draft had to survive what was expected to be a contentious public hearing and final vote the following week. The next day was a bad one, the worst so far in the pandemic. At Kinkle's small health care practice located in a low-slung brown brick building just a block from the Corn Palace. After her last patient of the day, Kinkle, 62, had hung up her only blue protective gown, tucked the N95 mask that she had been using since March in a paper bag, sat down at her desk, and took a sip of the cold coffee she had been trying to finish since morning. Her poodle, Junie B., a registered therapy dog, curled up in a sheepskin bed alongside her. Kinkle was barely out of the shower that morning when one of her longtime patients, a young mother of four, texted to say her coronavirus symptoms had worsened and she was having trouble breathing. With symptoms that acute, Kinkle would have normally sent the woman to the hospital, but there were no beds available, so she had to arrange to send oxygen to the woman's home. After that, Kinkle had a Zoom call with a firefighter who resisted going to the emergency room because he was afraid he was going to die. This was the week that the pandemic became personal. Four friends, including Timmons, had died. Kinkle herself was exhausted from having to come home, shower immediately, cook dinner while wearing a mask, then sleep separately from her husband, exhausted from not being able to touch or hug her patients, or hold their hands while she prayed for them. It felt like she was living in an alternative universe these days, where seriously ill COVID-19 patients overwhelmed the hospital and her clinic, and neighbors were dying as folks were living their lives, eating out in restaurants, drinking in bars, and attending weddings, funerals, and the Pheasants Forever fundraising banquet. Then there were the patients who didn't even believe the coronavirus was real. That week, a patient in his 40s came in for a physical. He was high risk and asthmatic and had his neck gaiter pushed down when she walked into the exam room. He said he couldn't breathe in it and didn't believe the whole pandemic thing anyway. People were dying from pneumonia because they were being forced to wear masks, he told her. The night of the final vote, a cold, clear evening in the 30s, more than 100 people gathered at the Corn Palace, sitting spaced out in the venue's faded blue folding seats. The world's only Corn Palace and its whimsical domes had showcased the town's agricultural bounty and brought tourists to town since 1892, and seen Mitchell through fires, floods, and the blizzards of 1949 and 1966. Now men and women stood ready to debate for hours over the utility of a 4x7-inch piece of cloth during the worst public health crisis the town had seen in a century. 13 deaths from COVID-19 had been reported in Davison County during the week between votes. The anti-maskers, energized by the earlier debate, sat with naked faces, defying the mayor's order. One by one, they got up to air their grievances. They wept, they swore, they cited junk science. Positivity defeats the virus. So does a healthy lifestyle, eating wild-caught sardines and pasture-raised beef liver, and drinking raw organic kombucha. A young mother stood up and compared anti-maskers to Jews persecuted in the Holocaust. The bare face is the new yellow star of Nazi Germany, she said. Mac Miller, 33, a member of the Army National Guard who did two tours overseas, got up to say he had sacrificed his family life to serve and protect the country's freedom. Wear a mask if you want to. That is your right, he said. Choice is what makes America, America. Our own voice, our own choice, our own freedoms. As the evening wore on, members of the beleaguered medical community could not hide their distress. I cannot even remember how many death certificates I have signed in the last few days, Buck Timmons' doctor, Lucio N. Margallo II, told the crowd. In fact, he had lost 8 people in the last week. Kinkle got up to speak following one anti-masker who seemed to be in the throes of a respiratory infection. I'm scared to stand right here because of the people coughing and hacking, she said before pleading. Please stand firm. We're dependent on you guys. Amen. After the public comment period was over, the council immediately got busy stripping the mandate of its penalties. They removed the city's fine, leaving only the court cost of about $90 should it come to that. They were opting for a soft approach, the mayor said, to educate people. We're putting together an ordinance that has no teeth, McArdle, the council president, protested. He had spent the week agonizing over his decision. He would miss his friend Buck Timmons at all the games, but he was also moved by the soldier. In the end, McArdle couldn't even bring himself to vote for the toothless mandate, which passed 5-3. By the end of the night, mostly anti-maskers remained in the auditorium. Kinkle had ducked out just after she spoke, going home to write up 18 patient charts before bed, including 6 patients seriously ill with COVID-19. She was long gone by the time one city councilman hopefully suggested that maybe they wouldn't have any mass citations after all this, and the mayor pointed at the crowd and said, "Did you listen to these people?" And they all laughed. A version of this story originally appeared in the Washington Post. Read one of the obituaries for you. The velvet-voiced singer who became country's first black star. Charlie Pride, 1934 to 2020. Charlie Pride grew up in the segregated Deep South at a time when aspiring black musicians had 2 options, play jazz or sing the blues. But Pride, raised by a strict father who turned the radio to the Grand Ole Opry, loved country, the whitest of American genres. The country business didn't initially love him back. RCA Records sent his first single to radio stations without publicity photos, hoping he'd be mistaken for white. When he began performing live, Pride put white audiences at ease by joking about his permanent tan. But with his honeyed baritone, Pride became country's first black superstar, landing 52 records in the country top 10 from 1966 to 1987, including 29 number ones. His biggest hit, 1971's Kiss an Angel Good Morning, sat on the pop chart for 4 months. Although proud of his trailblazing achievements, Pride, who died of complications from COVID-19, bristled at talk of race. "I'm no color," he said. "I'm just Charlie Pride, the man." He was born in Sledge, Mississippi, the 4th of 11 children in a family of sharecroppers, said the Washington Post. The kids slept 3 or 4 to a bed and picked cotton when not at school. Young Charlie was a fan of Hank Williams and bought a $10 Sears guitar at age 14. But he also idolized Jackie Robinson and thought baseball could be his way out of poverty. He left home at 16 to pitch for a Negro League team in Memphis. Pride tried out for several major league teams before an arm injury derailed his ball-playing dreams. He moved to Helena, Montana, where he shoveled coal at the smelting plant, said the New York Times. Country singers Red Sovine and Red Foley discovered Pride singing before a 1962 semi-pro baseball game and persuaded him to make a go of it in Nashville. Record executives loved his resonant baritone, but refused to believe a black man could play country. Now sing in your regular voice, he was told at one audition. Signed to RCA in 1965, Pride became the label's second biggest selling artist after Elvis Presley. His success was hard won. Producer Jack Clement hired musicians for Pride's first recording session by asking, I'm fixing to cut a record with this N-word. Are you free? A drunk George Jones once painted KKK on Pride's car. Nashville eventually accepted Pride. The Country Music Association named him Entertainer of the Year in 1971, and in 1993 he became a member of the Grand Ole Opry. Pride studiously avoided controversy, but in his 1994 memoir, he recalled how singer Webb Pierce had once told him, "It's good for you to be in our music," Pride replied. "It's my music, too." And we'll wind down on the Talking Points page, starting with an article titled, 2020, the worst year since... .. Is 2020 the worst year ever? Asked Stephanie Zacharick in Time.com. Most of us alive today have seen nothing like this one. Not since the spread of fascism in the 1930s have we been faced with so many abnormal events that have been so egregiously distorted by aberrant leadership. We witnessed apocalyptic wildfire devastation in California, watched George Floyd's life gruesomely snuffed out by Minneapolis police, and saw a presidential election contested on the basis of fantasy. Above all, we've suffered because of a virus that's killed 1.5 million, destroyed millions of livelihoods, and upended the lives of virtually everyone on the planet. Isolated in our bubbles, we've looked out at a world that seemed to be falling apart. It was bad, said Robert Allison in the Charleston, South Carolina Post and Courier. But when it comes to worst, it's not even a contender. Take 1919. After World War I killed 20 million and devastated Europe, when the death toll of the Spanish flu epidemic reached 50 million. Or 1968, when Martin Luther King Jr. and Bobby Kennedy were gunned down. America's cities burned, a losing war in Vietnam divided the nation, and the Hong Kong flu killed a million. Then there's 1942, said Richard Chin in the Minneapolis Star Tribune. The year of the Bataan Death March, the deadliest months of the Holocaust, and the beginning of the Battle of Stalingrad. Or any year of the Civil War. Or consider 536, when a volcanic eruption in Iceland sent a dark cloud over Europe and Asia that caused plunging temperatures, crop failures, and millions of starvation deaths. In the long scheme of human suffering over the ages, we ain't seen nothing. Yes, 2020 was rough, said Daniel Riley in GQ.com, but for so many aspects of life that needed changing, the pandemic was an accelerant. It opened the door to new ways of working, and with car and plane traffic way down, it offered a trial run on reducing carbon emissions. We had a long overdue reckoning with our policing and reimagined our cities, with streets closed to traffic and outdoor dining flourishing. We learn to value what matters. In the future, we may look back on 2020 not as a relentless slog of misfortune, but as the year the future was born. Here's a few of the shorter notes. Coronavirus deaths in communities that contain colleges have doubled since the end of August, compared with a 58% increase in communities without colleges. Nearly all of the deaths in college towns were of older people who came in contact with infected students. Shoplifting of food items such as baby formula, pasta, and bread is up markedly across the country, say retailers, police, and security experts. People will say, I was just hungry, said the manager of a Washington, D.C. supermarket, where thefts have more than doubled this year. An estimated 54 million Americans will struggle with hunger this winter, according to the U.S. Agriculture Department. Masks, gloves, and disinfectant wipes have become a prominent ocean pollutant. A significant portion of the estimated 129 billion masks and 65 billion gloves used each month end up in the world's oceans, according to a study by the journal Environmental Science and Technology. The Pentagon will distribute 44,000 doses of the coronavirus vaccine among military personnel starting this week. They'll go to senior officers, including the Defense Secretary and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, as well as military health care workers, but not to rank and file soldiers yet. And we'll finish out the show today with a quote from Bob Dylan, who says, "A man is a success if he gets up in the morning and gets to bed at night, and in between, does what he wants to." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.